I personally would not hold my breath or bet any amount of money on it that you couldn't cover with liquid assets, but it is at least a possibility, and as such, I think the Inslaw case, as I said, is potentially the most explosive and important of these various ongoing intersecting investigations, though not perhaps as sexy, quote-unquote, or as spectacular as things like the October Surprise. It should be noted that Joseph Daniel Casolaro, who had noted the various intersections between these investigations, was apparently not the first person to die, not the first journalist to die, I should say, in connection with these the pursuit of these investigations. It should be borne in mind, as I mentioned in the miscellaneous archive series about Inslaw, that there were a number of killings conducted in connection with the Inslaw case, notably a number of the Cabazon Indians who had objected to the Wackenhut-Cabazon joint venture. A number of them were dispatched as well. Contact Archives on Audio and get a hold of the miscellaneous archive show about Inslaw called We Have Ways of Making You Sell. There's a story in the San Jose Mercury News from the following day, that is to say Thursday, August 15th of 1991, indicating that Joseph Daniel Casolaro was not the first person to die pursuing this story. This is an AP story, Dateline Charleston, West Virginia, and it is headlined, Suicide, quote-unquote, on trail of BCCI is second mysterious death. A freelance journalist killed in July also was on the story. Skipping down in the story, it reads in part, Dan dealt, this is to say, Dan, that is Joseph Daniel Casolaro, Dan dealt in this nebulous, shadowy world, said Dick O'Connell, a friend of Casolaro's and publisher of Washington Crime News Services, which publishes more than a dozen law enforcement-related newsletters. Quote, he was saying they, quote-unquote, took that Inslaw software and sold it overseas and took the profits from that and turned it into arms for the Contras, O'Connell said Wednesday. Again, quoting, that's what he was working on, and he told me he thought BCCI was the conduit for all these money transactions. Unquote. O'Connell noted that Senator Alan Cranston, Democrat of California, said at a hearing on BCCI last week that a freelance journalist killed July 29th in Guatemala City had told acquaintances he was working on a big story, quote-unquote, related to BCCI in Guatemala. The reporter, Anson Ng Yong, N-G, capital Y-O-N-G, a Malaysian-born British citizen, was found dead in his apartment with a single gunshot wound in his head in what Cranston said had the appearances of a professional killing. Cranston said Ng's murder was suspected to be related to arms trafficking allegedly carried out by BCCI in collusion with top leaders of Guatemalan military. However, Guatemalan Interior Minister Fernando Hurtado Prem, a PREM, quickly discounted a political link, calling Ng's killing, quote, a common crime, unquote. And diplomats, investigators, and friends of Ng in Guatemala, who spoke on condition of anonymity, have said they saw no evidence of a connection to the BCCI scandal. Family members, friends, and colleagues have said Casolaro couldn't have killed himself and believed he was close to proving a link between the Inslaw case, BCCI, and the alleged delay in the release of American hostages in Iran until after President Reagan took office in 1981. Quote, I believe he had the final necessary link to give it credibility and plausibility, and that's the reason they took him out, unquote, O'Connell said. Again, quoting, there is no way this man could have committed suicide, unquote. Inslaw owner Bill Hamilton said Casolaro had been warned many times that his life was in danger as he tried to link the three stories. Quote, common sense would dictate that where people's reputations and, in fact, perhaps criminal activities are questioned, that they're going to want to protect that, unquote, said Alan Boyack, B-O-Y-A-C-K, an attorney in St. George, Utah. Boyack had been retained to assist one of the individuals who claims to be a major player, quote, unquote, in both the Inslaw case and the hostage release. I don't know who that individual is, but I would certainly like to know. Again, note, for the purposes of record here, that apparently Joseph Daniel Casolaro, not the first writer to go down in connection with these ongoing investigations. It is to be hoped that he is the last writer to go down. It is not a pleasant situation to see a development of this kind. I would also note that, once again, the very tragic fact of this country's having ignored its ongoing history of political assassination rears its head. It's always interesting to me to watch how journalists, both mainstream journalists and so-called progressive journalists, handle cases like this. This country has, as I've said before in connection with Mort Saul's phrase, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? Regrettably, the United States and its people, including and especially its journalistic community at this point, do belong to the lie. They have for so many years now adhered to the preposterous, untenable thesis that this country does not have political assassinations, whereas all other major powers in the history of the human race have had political assassinations. For some reason, we do not. Well, that's childish, actually. And unfortunately, it is a childish belief which has taken hold and has assumed the value of truth, both in terms of the American historical, political, and journalistic communities. It's always interesting to me to watch when the obvious fallacy that hypothesis holds, when that fallacy is revealed for being the obvious piece of BS that it is. It's interesting to me to watch how people handle this particular case, and are in any case which disproves the contention that this country does not have political assassinations. Whenever a major investigation breaks with regard to the intelligence community, it is always followed and accompanied by a wave of very mysterious deaths. This has been in the case of so many different investigations that we've looked at in the past, the Iran-Contra investigation, Edwin Wilson's trials, the assassinations of John and Robert Kennedy and other people. We took a look at a massive series of deaths in connection with the investigation of the Vatican banking scandals and the other machinations relative to the Propaganda Due Lodge, a bogus Masonic lodge in Italy that became a crypto-fascist government and was inextricably linked, a crypto-fascist government for Italy and was inextricably linked with NATO. Unfortunately, as I've said, this country has given itself for so long to the obviously incorrect view that we do not have political assassinations, that it makes it very difficult for anyone to approach a tragic death like Daniel Casolaro's in any kind of objective framework. One more article from the San Jose Mercury News appeared, and this is from the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, August 16th of 1991. This is a Washington Post story datelined Martinsburg, West Virginia, and headlined, "Writer's Death Called Apparent Suicide." I would also point out that as we read in the original article, the Boston Globe article from the Mercury News of 8/14, that the body had been embalmed, and that's illegal because it had been embalmed before the family had been notified of the death. That is manifestly illegal, and obviously has made any sort of serious forensic determination infinitely more difficult. A couple of other details to take note of here about Joseph Daniel Casolaro's death. In the first place, his notes were missing. Also, there was a half-consumed bottle of wine in his hotel room, but there was no sign of alcohol in blood samples taken before Casolaro's body was embalmed on Sunday. Once again, Washington Post, dateline Martinsburg, West Virginia, as reported in the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, August 16th of 1991. Skipping down in the story, Anthony Casolaro, an Arlington, Virginia physician and the victim's brother, said in an interview that Casolaro always traveled with notes for the book he was writing and that there were no notes found in the Martinsburg hotel room. Quote, "The circumstances around it are so compelling in support of foul play," unquote, he said, including, quote, "the fact that the notes were not there and the fact that he was not at all suicidal in the estimation of many people. What we have there is not inconsistent with suicide," James Frost, deputy chief medical examiner, told a Martinsburg news conference after an autopsy. Quote, "That doesn't mean it could not have been done by other means. We're not ruling out foul play, but I have no evidence of it at this time." The probe into the investigative reporter's death is incomplete, he said, and will include blood tests, an analysis of a note found with the body, and a psychological profile. Skipping down into the article, some inconsistent evidence emerged in the investigation, however. A partially full wine bottle was found in the hotel room, for example, but there was no sign of alcohol in blood samples taken before Casolaro's body was embalmed Sunday. I would take note not only of those inconsistencies, but also of something that we have taken a look at over the years on this particular broadcast, and I would refer listeners to a miscellaneous archive show called So You Thought You Were Free, an analysis of 1 week's news events in August of 1989, about 2 years ago. It is a matter of public record that our national security establishment, that is to say the military and intelligence services, have long had means of disposing of people in such a way as to make it look like an accidental death. Even the best toxicological examination would not necessarily reveal the presence of one or another of these lethal instrumentalities, but it certainly is disturbing to know that the body was embalmed illegally before the family had been notified. That is, as I said, illegal, and obviously will make any sort of intelligent forensic determination infinitely more difficult under the circumstances. I would take note of the death of Daniel Casolaro. I would also take note of the assassination of Shapur Bakhtiar shortly after the announcement of the opening of the House Foreign Affairs Committee's probe into October's surprise. I wonder if we're going to be seeing a lot more deaths in connection with this particular story. I also will recall for listeners that in Harry Martin's October Surprise series, in an article published on Friday, June 14th of 1991, one of the people listed as one of the intermediaries in the alleged money transfer route for some of the funds used in the October Surprise was a fellow named Alan Michael May, a former Nixon aide. Alan Michael May privately expressed to Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel the his desire not to have the information published because he feared for his life if it was. Alan Michael May then on Wednesday, June 19th, died of an apparent heart attack, although he had been in good health at the age of 50. There have been a number of chilling deaths like this in connection with this particular case, and it is to be hoped that there won't be any more, but I would be willing to bet there will be others. I would also take note of the fact that yours truly has been pursuing information in much the same regard, although I generally stick with printed information. My lines of argument are unnervingly similar to what Joseph Daniel Casolaro has been pointing out. And I would also point out that the metaphor he used of the octopus is one that I myself have used on a number of different occasions over the years in order to describe the intersections of these various investigations, which initially I have approached as separate entities and which then over a period of time have emerged. In a recent interview, for example, with a fellow named Gunther Rosbacher, a high-ranking naval intelligence and CIA operative who maintains he was involved in the October surprise, I mentioned during the course of the interview that I was treading a little more lightly than I normally would in an interview, simply because I did not want to get someone killed, whether it's myself or Gunther Rosbacher or his wife or somebody else. And unfortunately, given the track record of these particular investigations, that's a consideration that one cannot overlook under the circumstances. I would simply take note for the record of my use in at least one archive show. I've used the octopus metaphor many times over the years. For the record, one of those times included in the archives was in a miscellaneous archive show, which is from November 4th of 1990, in which I interviewed Daniel Sheehan, chief counsel for the Christic Institute. And after listening to Daniel Sheehan's description of the intersections of a number of these cases, I used the octopus metaphor once again. And just for curiosity, I'm going to play a short section of this particular tape. This is from, once again, a miscellaneous archive show of an interview that I did with Daniel Sheehan on November 4th of 1990.
What's interesting is... We're in more or less the same generation, Dan. One of the things that I compare a lot of this material to, so many of the... Although, obviously, it's all related to the national security establishment. Over the past few years, so many of the different topics that I have been talking about and that we've been researching on this broadcast have begun to merge. Institutions like the P2 Lodge and the shooting of the Pope and the many scandals breaking are now intersecting directly with the Iran-Contra scandal. And so many different things are... there's been so much convergence of different elements that it's almost like one of those 50s horror movies, you know, where you see the giant octopus rising beside the boat, you know, and you've got the ubiquitous 50 horror movie cast. You know, you've got the hero, and then there's the girl who always falls down.
Richard Carlson is always there.
He's girl as opposed to woman, because it seems that always that the woman is frail, and then no matter how slow the monster moves, she always has to fall down in front of it so that the hero can rescue her. And then there's the professor who always wants to save the monster in the interest of science.
Who's usually the father of the young
right.
lady.
Of course, he gets eaten usually, and then the hero saves the girl. But there's always a scene with a giant octopus. The monster reveals itself for the first time, and you've seen a few people get snuffed, and you've seen footprints, and they organize a search party. They send out a few troops, and then the monster rises beside the boat, and first you see a few tentacles, and then you see a few more tentacles, and finally the head comes up, and you realize what the monster is about. And it's almost... That's similar to what's been happening with regard to this case.
Well, it's interesting, Steve, because this is the part of the facilitating role that the Christic Institute case plays.
And once again, just for curiosity and or historical sake, my use of the very same metaphor that Joseph Daniel Casolaro had used, and I hope that if I turn up an apparent suicide or an apparent heart attack victim or an apparent stroke victim, or if I get hit by a car or if something else happens, I hope that the listening audience will not take my death at face value either. I do not have any hard immediate leads as Joseph Daniel Casolaro apparently did, yet at the same time I don't discount the possibility of something like that happening. In any event, we're now going to take a musical break, and we will come back with more of the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. I'm going to proceed now with the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. We have just finished with a look at the very tragic and, I suspect, sinister death of Joseph Daniel Casolaro, an individual who was investigating something he termed the octopus, namely the ongoing links or the many manifest links between a number of the ongoing investigations figuring in the news these days. We're going to take a look at one of these many links, namely a link between a person implicated in the BCCI scandal, the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, and the October surprise. By the way, in future weeks, either next week or the week after, I will be doing an archive show about the BCCI. I'd like to give the case a little more time to ripen, so to speak. There are many articles that have come out, undoubtedly, that I have not seen. I want a chance to hunt some of those down. Also, there will be new articles, I dare say, coming out ere long about the BCCI. One of the many links connecting some of the tentacles of the octopus, as Joseph Daniel Castellaro referred to it, concerns a link between the BCCI and the October surprise. This following article comes from the Los Angeles Times of Friday, August 2nd, for 1991. This is an article by Sarah Fritz, F-R-I-T-Z, of the L.A. Times. It's Dateline Washington and headlined, "Lobbyists' Role Cited for Lack of BCCI Inquiry." It reads in part as follows. The Ronald Reagan administration, under heavy pressure from high-powered Washington lobbyists hired by the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, repeatedly ignored evidence that the Abu Dhabi-owned bank was operating illegally in the United States, a congressional committee was told Thursday. Former U.S. Customs Commissioner William von Raab, RAAB, and former Senate investigator Jack Blum, BLUM, in testimony before a Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee, outlined a list of developments during the 1980s that they said provided the government with evidence of misconduct by BCCI. In each case, they said, the government failed to pursue the evidence aggressively. Von Raab blamed the influence of lobbyists and public relations firms hired by BCCI for discouraging the government from conducting a full investigation of the bank. Quote, there wasn't a single influence peddler who wasn't being used to work this case, unquote, he said. Again quoting, if you were to get the BCCI Rolodex for its influence peddlers, you would have the blue chip list, unquote. Von Raab, now a private attorney, mentioned the names of four influential Washingtonians, three Democrats and one Republican, that he said he believes were instrumental in helping to squelch any investigation of BCCI. They are Clark M. Clifford, advisor to several Democratic presidents and chairman of BCCI-controlled First American Bank in Washington, Robert Altman, Clifford's protege, and first American president, Robert Gray, Republican public relations consultant, and Frank Mankiewicz, one-time press secretary to Robert F. Kennedy, and now a business partner of Gray. The individual that I see here as being most significant, and the individual I'm going to focus on here, is the aforementioned Robert Gray, or Robert Keith Gray, an individual who has, as I like to say, more connections, than a switchboard, and, interestingly enough, an individual whose name has cropped up in connection with the October surprise. Research credit on the following goes to a listener. This comes from the Village Voice of July 16th of 1991. In Doug Ireland's press clippings column, there is a reference to an ABC Nightline program about the October surprise. One of the pieces of information turned up by this program was that Robert Keith Gray's name was on the register for a Madrid, Spain hotel in which some of the alleged participants in the October surprise were supposed to have stayed. Among those who were supposed to have stayed there were the late William Casey, director of the CIA at the time of the, he was manager of the Reagan-Bush campaign and later on became head of the Central Intelligence Agency. And interestingly enough, in their search for of these hotel records, they came across the name of Robert Keith Gray present at one of the hotels at the time the deal was supposedly going down, that is to say the October surprise deal. About this information, Doug Ireland writes as follows. Meanwhile, here's some more on the CIA connections of Robert Gray, the Reagan intimate who was Bill Casey's number two man in the 1980 campaign and whose name turned up in Nightline's search of records for that Madrid hotel during the days when Casey is said to have met there with senior Iranians. See press clips July 2nd. My eagle-eyed confrere, John Whalen, who monitors the media for the San Jose-based Weekly Metro, wrote in his June 27th, July 3rd column, quote, in Manhunt, his book on renegade CIA officer Edwin P. Wilson, who got caught selling Semtex plastic explosives to Libya, journalist Peter Maas, M-A-A-S, describes Gray as an éminence grise. He was a director at Wilson's CIA front company, Consultants International. In 1969, he accompanied Wilson on a two-week excursion to Taiwan, where Wilson inspected CIA cargoes. Gray sponsored Wilson's membership in Washington's Sheikh Georgetown Club, which had Gray as its first president and was described in a 1978 congressional probe as an intelligence front for the Korean government. And Gray vouched for Wilson in a top-secret Navy review, describing Wilson as a person of, quote, unqualified trust, unquote, and someone with whom he had been in touch professionally two or three times a month, unquote, since 1963. Given the Frontline report on the existence of a network of retired and serving CIA officers who supported the Reagan-Bush campaign, Gray's extensive connections to the company offer a fertile field for investigation when and if Congress gets around to it. Once again, Robert Keith Gray, an intimate of Edwin Wilson, a person whose lobbying efforts on behalf of BCCI is credited by some with having forestalled a formal investigation into that scandalous institution, an individual whose name has turned up in the Madrid Hotel Register at the time when Casey and company, no pun intended, were supposedly cutting this particular deal. Worth noting again, Robert Keith Gray, the number two man behind William Casey in the Reagan-Bush campaign of 1980. Hard evidence that that campaign was in touch with some of the Iranian militants involved in the taking of U.S. hostages from the embassy in November of 1979 comes from this very same column, Press Clips, by Doug Ireland in the Village Voice of July 16th of 1991. Another unasked question. As the nation's Christopher Hitchens wrote in his July 4th, 1987 column, the House investigation into the theft of Jimmy Carter's campaign papers, known as Debategate, revealed that, quote, secret documents from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran were found in the files of Edwin Meese and Anthony Dolan, now Reagan's chief speechwriter. The committee determined that, quote, these copies were obtained from Iran after being in the possession of Iranians, unquote. One of those documents, unearthed from Meese's file, has an attached handwritten note of acknowledgement from Reagan signed Ron. Quote, quote-unquote, where in the world did Meese get those documents? So again, hard information that there was, in fact, active contact between the Iranian militants and the Reagan-Bush campaign. Obviously, this offers a fertile field for investigation, as Doug Ireland indicated, and it'll be interesting to know what, if anything, comes of the investigation of Robert Keith Gray. Also, from the Village Voice of July 2nd of 1991, there is information about the Hashemi brothers' arms smuggling case, and there were FBI transcripts in connection with this case, and according to Hashemi's former attorney, a man named Wachtel, there are transcripts of these particular tapes, and these particular transcripts could be among the very hard pieces of evidence in the October surprise investigation, if in fact they are subpoenaed. Reading now from the Village Voice of July 2nd of 1991, this particular section of this article reads, the national press, however, is finally beginning to pick up on the October surprise story. This is from an article called Why No One Wants to Investigate the October Surprise. This, by the way, was also sent to me by a listener. This comes from a computer bulletin board. On June 20th, Ted Koppel and Jeff Greenfield broadcast a special edition of ABC's Nightline devoted to the claims of Iranian-born arms dealer Jamshid Hashemi, J-A-M-S-H-I-D, capital H-A-S-H-E-M-I, who says he participated in meetings between then-Reagan campaign chair William Casey and Iranian cleric Mehdi Karubi, K-A-R-R-U-B-I, at Madrid's Hotel Ritz in July and August of 1980. The show not only committed Nightline's considerable financial resources, but its prestige as well. In 1984, Rudolph Giuliani brought indictments against all three Hashemis, accusing them of violating the law against selling arms to Iran. Court documents show that following the death of Cyrus Hashemi, all charges against him were terminated. If the charges against Jamshid are still outstanding, as appears to be the case, ABC, which knew where Hashemi was hiding in Washington this week, he has since returned to London, could be open to questions from federal prosecutors. The prominence given by Nightline to Hashemi's claim that he, along with his brothers Cyrus and Reza, made four weapons deliveries worth $150 million to Iran from Israeli arsenals by January of 1981 will certainly increase demands for public disclosure of evidence lodged in the government's case against them. Gary Sick, S-I-C-K, the self-described point man of the Carter administration's efforts to ransom the hostages, has said that U.S. Customs began taping all of the brothers' conversations at their New York offices on October 21st of 1980. That was the day after Casey met with the Hashemis, Iranians, Israelis, and others in a Paris hotel to finalize terms of the hostage deal. If any evidence exists that would confirm the Hashemis' relationship with the Reagan campaign, it would almost certainly be on those tapes. Because the tapes were used as the basis for the indictments against the Hashemi brothers, their lawyers were given access to transcripts under discovery. William Wachtel, W-A-C-H-T-E-L, Cyrus Hashemi's attorney at the time, says he still has transcripts of the tapes and that they will, quote, shed new light, unquote, on the alleged Reagan-Bush election conspiracy and the relationship between Hashemi and Casey. But Wachtel says he will not release the tapes until he is subpoenaed by Congress because he has received a, quote, threatening, unquote, letter from the CIA warning of prosecution if the transcripts are made public. When the FBI was asked to produce the tapes for news reporters, the agency responded by saying that they were lost. Quote, The notion that one of the agencies has lost the tapes is unacceptable, Pennsylvania Representative Peter Kostmeyer, K-O-S-T-M-A-Y-E-R, said in an interview on June 24th. Kostmeyer has written letters to the CIA, FBI, and U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District in New York, requesting that the tapes be found and turned over to Congress. Quote, "The tapes that could prove that a presidential election was tampered with have been lost. That is absurd," unquote, Kostmeyer said, again quoting, "What do you mean the tapes have been lost," unquote. But as Wachtell points out, the tapes will not become available unless Congress issues a subpoena. Quote, "You don't understand what I'm saying," unquote, said Mike O'Neill, an aide to Speaker Foley, when asked why his office had not tried to locate the tapes. Quote, "We're not doing an investigation. We're just collecting information." Yep, unquote. It is to be hoped that those tapes, the transcripts of those tapes, do indeed get subpoenaed, because they could offer one of the very hard investigative possibilities into October's surprise. And this particular observer is certainly hoping that they do indeed get subpoenaed. We've discussed the Hashemi arms deal in the past. By the way, the entire October surprise scenario is covered in Radio Free America program number 31 and its various addenda. We last discussed the Hashemi situation in connection with a fellow named J. Stanley Pottinger, a former Nixon Ford Justice Department official, specifically an assistant attorney general, an individual who is described in Donald Freed and Fred Landis' book Death in Washington as having actively obstructed the investigations into the assassinations of Orlando Letelier and Martin Luther King. In the book Labyrinth by Eugene Proper and Saul Landau, the aforementioned J. Stanley Pottinger is described as a good friend of George Bush. He also was a very, very good friend at the time of the alleged deal, including the Hashemi's arms selections, with Gloria Steinem, the Diane of American Feminism, and herself an individual with a background in the Central Intelligence Agency. The aforementioned J. Stanley Pottinger's name cropped up in connection with the Hashemi arms investigation in 1984, and on July 14th of this year, that is to say 1991, I reviewed a section from that particular One Step Beyond show from June 17th of 1984, documenting the apparent involvement of J. Stanley Pottinger in the Hashemi arms situations. With the Bush-Pottinger relationship, I think J. Stanley Pottinger is at least possibly one of the more promising investigative leads to link George Bush personally to the alleged October surprise deal. This will not, however, that is to say the October surprise, will not be the easiest of cases to bring to investigation because of the many, many connections to ongoing people and interests that are powerful enough to dissuade such an investigation. We're going to take a short musical break now, and then we're going to come back with some more information. The final section of the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast, we're going to take a look at a couple of disturbing facts concerning the murder of Shapur Bakhtiar. We're going to take a look also at an interesting connecting link between the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring and the brother of an individual implicated in BCCI. And finally, we're going to take a look at a very significant development vis-a-vis the investigation of the Iran-Contra scandal that has emerged in Costa Rica this past week. Music, and then the final section of the prepared portion of tonight's program. We're going to proceed now with the prepared portion of tonight's program, the final installment of the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. We're going to look at two articles, first of all, pertaining to the investigation, or perhaps alleged investigation would be a more appropriate term under the circumstances, into the recent assassination of Shapur Bakhtiar. Bakhtiar was Iran's last prime minister under the Shah of Iran, an individual who had been very critical of the current government of Iran, and an individual who may, I say may, have had information about some aspect or another of the October surprise. His murder followed by 4 days the announcement by Lee Hamilton that, in fact, there would be an investigation of October surprise by the House Foreign Affairs Committee. It should be noted that former Iranian President Abul Hassan Bani Sadra, an individual who has definitely come out in connection or in support of the October surprise, he mentioned in articles that I read on the air last week that he had been told that the same Iranian hit teams were after him as well. One of the questions I have concerning the case is whether the assassination of a Shapur Bakhtiar might also be connected in some way with October surprise. As I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. The following article appeared in the New York Times of Wednesday, August 14th of 1991. This is an article by Alan Riding, or Reading, R-I-D-I-N-G. Dateline Paris and headline, "Suspects in Iranian's Killing Were Detained Briefly." The article reads in part as follows. Two Iranians now suspected of killing former Prime Minister Shapur Bakhtiar, B-A-K-H-T-I-A-R, of Iran, were briefly detained by the Swiss and French border police last week after trying to illegally cross into Switzerland, French officials said today. The two were freed after questioning by the French police, who had not yet been alerted to the killing of Mr. Bakhtiar and an aide, and were last seen heading south, possibly toward the French borders with Italy and Spain. The two men, who entered France with Iranian passports under the names Mohammed Azadi, A-Z-A-D-I, and Ali Rad Vakili, V-A-K-I-L-I, reportedly tried to cross into Switzerland near Geneva last Wednesday using Turkish passports bearing the names Musa Korser, K-O-C-E-R, and Ali Kaya, K-A-Y-A. But the Swiss border police turned them away after concluding that their Swiss entry visas were falsified. French officials said they were returned to the French border, where they were interrogated by the French police and released after it was determined that they had valid French visas and were not wanted for any crime. It should be noted that that apparently was not the only time that these individuals escaped apprehension under the circumstances. Reading now from the New York Times of Saturday, August 17th of 1991, just a few days later, we have the following story, which is an AP story, Dateline Geneva, and headline, Suspect in Iranian's Death Eludes the Police, and this reads in part as follows. For the second time in 10 days, a suspect in the slaying of former Prime Minister Shapur Bakhtiar of Iran slipped through the hands of the police because of a mix-up, a police spokesman said. The suspect's hotel registration card was inserted into a police computer after he checked into a downtown hotel on Monday, but a computer failure delayed the identification process until Wednesday, said the spokesman Thierry Magnin, M-A-G-N-I-N. By that time, the suspect, Ali Rad Vakili, had checked out, Mr. Magnin said. Mr. Vakili was carrying a Turkish passport with the name Musa Koser, which was registered in the police computer when it checked names of people on the wanted list. Mr. Bakhtiar was fatally stabbed in his home outside Paris on August 6th, according to coroner's reports. Iranian exiles have blamed the Iranian government for the assassination. Tehran has denied the charges. Well, these two stories obviously are not conclusive in and of themselves, but they do raise suspicions concerning the vigor and integrity of the investigation into Shapur Bakhtiar's death. One of the questions that arises is whether perhaps there might be some powerful interests actively covering for these particular assassins or alleged assassins. Not a conclusion we can draw, but certainly a possibility that suggests itself in light of the information presented in those two articles. And once again, I cite the death of Shapur Bakhtiar and also the threats communicated to Abul Hassan Bani Sadr that the same groups were after him. And I wonder whether perhaps this assassination's timing might have had something to do with the October surprise. Once again, that's in the category of food for thought and grounds for further research. I would take note that the Bush administration recently relaxed U.S. counterterrorism efforts, this in spite of the indications that terrorism may very well be on the rise. Although there are optimistic developments vis-a-vis hostages in the Middle East, it should be noted that there are also signs of renewed terrorism from that part of the world as well, the assassination of Shapur Bakhtiar as well as the assassination of the Japanese translator for the Satanic Verses being two of the many indications that that is the case. In the San Francisco Examiner for today being Sunday, August 18th of 1991, there's a story by Michael Frisby of the Boston Globe, last name F-R-I-S-B-Y. It's headlined, GOP Mideast Report Differs with Bush. It's subheaded, House Panel Study Says Area is Under Increased Threat from Terrorists. The article reads in part as follows. A report compiled by a House Republican research group has concluded that the Middle East is under increased threat of terrorist attacks and is more volatile following the Persian Gulf War, a view at odds with that of the Bush administration. The report, just released by the 16-member House Republican Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, cites the shifting of 10,000 Palestine Liberation Organization fighters to Iraq in April and recent arms sales to Syria and Iran. It contradicts the administration's assertions that the Gulf War, skipping down in the story, that the Gulf War produced a Middle East prepared for pragmatic compromises and that the United States could shape the debate in the aftermath. Quote, the U.S. peace effort is paradoxically making the Middle East more volatile by radicalizing the Arab public and stigmatizing those moderate leaders who seek to work with it, unquote, according to the 20-page report. Representative William McCollum, capital M-C, capital C-O-L-L-U-M, Republican of Florida, the task force chairman, said, quote, it is clear from our research and our staff's research that there is an ongoing operation for terrorism and the potential for its use is as great as ever, unquote. McCollum said the administration had overlooked the signs that a major terrorism campaign was being organized. Skipping down on the story, Noel Koch, K-O-C-H, the counterterrorism director at the Pentagon during the Reagan administration, said he had not read the report, but that the threat of terrorism had increased from a, quote, tremendous feeling of resentment, unquote, by Arabs. Well, I would note a couple of things in connection with this particular report. First of all, one of the individuals involved with this particular House Republican group is Vaughn Forrest, one of the participants with Oliver North in the Iran-Contra affair. And I would also take note here of the statements by Noel Koch, described as the counterterrorism director at the Pentagon during the Reagan administration. Noel Koch is an individual with strong professional associations with, among others, Robert Keith Gray, the BCCI lobbyist and a former number two man in the Reagan-Bush campaign, whose name cropped up in the Hotel Ritz register in Madrid at the time that Casey and company were allegedly cutting the deal for October's surprise. We covered Koch in Radio Free America number 30. Now, one of the major elements of this broadcast over the years concerns the ongoing connections between elements of the U.S. national security establishment and some of the very terrorists, Arab and otherwise, that that national security establishment is supposedly working against. The main scenario that we want to be aware of here is that of provocation, namely the setting up of a terrorist incident in order to justify the domestic or overseas reaction against that particular act. Some of the connections between elements of our national security establishment and some of the terrorists that they are supposedly opposed to can be found in the following archive shows: Radio Free America program number 4, Radio Free America programs 19 through 23, Radio Free America programs 30, 31, 32, 34, and 35, as well as a two-part miscellaneous archive series about the fascist third position. I realize that I'm going quickly and glossing over a major element of these programs relatively quickly. I can only ask the tolerance of the listener and encourage those listeners who would like to pursue this information further to go and examine the relevant archive shows under the circumstances. One of the things that I'm scared about when I notice, on the one hand, the Bush administration relaxing its counter-terror efforts, and on the other hand, an obviously partisan congressional group warning that, in fact, Middle Eastern terrorism may be on the rise, is I wonder perhaps whether we're going to see an increase in exactly that sort of terrorism, perhaps aided and abetted by some of the very people supposedly opposing it. One of the things that I've read on this program in the past concerns a quote by Donald Gregg, a former CIA official and now currently U.S. ambassador to South Korea, who perhaps most significantly for our purposes was George Bush's national security advisor at the time he was vice president. Donald Gregg warned Congress in 1975 and 6 as the Pike and Church committees were investigating CIA misdeeds. Donald Gregg, as described in the book The Phoenix Program by Douglas Ballantyne, warned Congress, quote, back off or face martial law, unquote. Well, one of the things that we've looked at in Radio Free America program number 32 and addenda concerns the active plans by elements of the Reagan-Bush administration, notably Ollie North, the National Security Council, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to implement martial law in the event of any one of a number of possibilities, including the eventuality of terrorism in the United States. I am concerned that if, in fact, some of the ongoing investigations that the late unfortunate Joseph Daniel Casolaro termed as the octopus, if one or more of these investigations should mushroom in such a way as to threaten the Reagan or the Bush administration, I'm worried that we might see an invocation of the Rex 84 Operation Night Train martial law scenarios if, in fact, the Bush administration feels it has nothing else left. Obviously not a statement we can make absolutely, but it's a possibility I don't think we can afford to overlook, and I frankly find that particular report terrifying under the circumstances. I hope that it does not portend what I'm afraid it might portend. Once again, as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. By the way of documenting, for the benefit of relatively new listeners, some of the connections between elements of the U.S. intelligence establishment and some of the very terrorists that that intelligence establishment is supposedly working against, elements of it do work against it, but unfortunately there are other elements that work for it. Research credit on the following article, which documents some of these ongoing connections, or some of the connections between the U.S. intelligence system and some of the terrorists it supposedly is working against, research credit on the following article goes to Dave, our Italian translator. He got this particular article from Il Mondo of February 25th of 1985. You're going to hear a lot of names here. Now, the three most important names are those of Gabriel Tanuri, T-A-N-N-O-U-R-I. We're going to talk about him in a minute, an intimate of Colonel Gaddafi. A man named Mazed Rashad Faron, that's M-A-Z-E-D-R-A-S-H-A-D-P-H-A-R-A-O-N, the brother of Gaït Faron, one of the key players in the BCCI scandal. And last, but most assuredly not least, Glauco Partel, first name G-L-A-U-C-O, last name P-A-R-T-E-L, an individual who not only had worked for a long time with the U.S. intelligence system, but an individual who we looked at in a big way in Radio Free America number 20 in connection with the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring. Now, Stibom, That's Stibam International. It's spelled S-T-I-B-A-M. It is not, unfortunately, a name that is very well known to the public, but it is a name very well known to longtime listeners of this program, and Stibam, most significantly for our purposes, was one of the central elements involved in the assassination attempt on Pope John Paul II in May of 1981. That assassination attempt described in great detail in the archive shows Radio Free America program 17 through 21. One of the main names to know in connection with the Pope shooting and Stibam is that of Bekir Çelenk, described as the paymaster for the plot against the Pope, himself affiliated with the Grey Wolves, the youth wing of the National Action Party, the Turkish neo-Nazi and pan-Turkist party, and it was a member of that party, Mehmet Ali Ajak, who attempted to assassinate the Pope in cooperation with some Confederates. Stibam was inextricably linked with the U.S. National Security Establishment in a variety of different ways. Many U.S. intelligence agents worked with it, including an intimate of Edwin Wilson named Eugene Bartholomaeus, the aforementioned Glauco Partel, Henry Arsan, last named A-R-S-A-N, the head of the Stibam Arms for Drugs ring, had been working as an informant for the DEA for many, many years. Inextricable links between the DEA and other intelligence agencies in this country are one of the factors we're going to be looking at in the article. To follow this, we took a look at DEA-CIA connections in Radio Free America shows 26 and 27. Now, one of the things that's significant about this particular article is it concerns the active participation by the aforementioned Glauco Partel and Mazed Rashad Faron, brother of Gayit Faron, one of the principals in the BCCI scandal, and Anthony Gabriel Tanuri, an intimate of Colonel Gaddafi, to obtain three atomic bombs for Libya. And one of the things that I'm concerned about in connection with a possible Rex 84 Operation Night Train scenario would be the turning up of nuclear material or a nuclear weapon from Saddam Hussein's stockpile. I'm worried that we might perhaps see a nuclear terrorist incident, either attempted or actual, against elements in this country, and that this would serve as a pretext for the establishment of martial law. Reading now the article translated and researched for us by Dave, this from Il Mondo of February 25th of 1985. And again, the three names to remember here, Anthony Gabriel Tanuri, Mazed Rashad Faron, and Glauco Partel. The article reads, Anthony Gabriel Tanuri, T-A-N-N-O-U-R-I, 39, Lebanese by birth, Panamanian passport, number 98, French residence, Paris and Monte Carlo, Libyan by friendship, an intimate of Colonel Gaddafi. Police arrested him January 29, 1984, for drug trafficking. His name was found in documents on a Turkish truck driver arrested for drugs. His lawyers said the guilty man was really one Antoine Assad Tanuri, and they asked for an annulment of the sentence handed down in August of 1982. Tanuri was a brilliant financier, international businessman, personal friend of Richard Nixon and of ex-French Prime Minister Raymond Barre, and escort of such women as Jacqueline Kennedy, Princess Caroline, and Anouk Aimée. But there was another arrest warrant out for him issued July 2, 1983, by Judge Carlo Palermo of Trento. I would interrupt, Judge Carlo Palermo was the judge who was investigating Stibam. Documents showed that Tanuri, for a period of 3 years, was at the center of attempts to sell nuclear material, especially chosen to furnish Libya with atomic weapons. A business of $1.2 billion, which involved leaders, Secret Service, traffickers, financiers, and professionals. It all started February 8th of 1980. That day, a Venezuelan group headed by two mysterious people, Diego Arias, A-R-I-A-S, and Elio Guerrero, G-U-E-R-R-E-R-O, signed an agreement with the Libyan government to furnish materials and technology in the nuclear field. A secret contract deposited in Geneva, certified by 15 famous lawyers and rich in names of people, Arab and otherwise, interested in the transaction. It amounted to $1,017,000. Tanuri was entrusted with realizing this contract and was authorized to involve an Arab financier known for his sensible and astute conduct in delicate negotiations. This man was Mazed Rashad Faron, capital P-H-A-R-A-O-N, Saudi brother of the more famous Gayit Faron, businessman who, among other things, recently held briefly 10% of Industri Bitone Perugina, now passed into the hands of Carlo De Benedetti. Faron entered this affair near the beginning, but he kept a certain distance, which appears almost suspicious. He didn't sign many documents. Tanuri and Faron reached an agreement in September of 1980. On September 22nd, Faron's first letter, through one of his companies, Mafar of Jeddah, The financier communicated to Biso Electronics, that's B-I-S-O, Biso Electronics Company, based in Mahé in the Seychelles, that's M-A-H-E, confirmation of the acquisition of 3 containers of electrical generating equipment, actually nuclear material. Faron had it in Geneva. Apparently, there was a dispute between a Venezuelan dealer and one from France. Tanuri had to spend $36 million to stop it.